I studied fine arts in a school that is called École des Arts Décoratifs. It's any school in France. The department in which I was, it used to be a school connected to Bauhaus. Everything made to have like different departments, like wood, glass, etc., etc. And then there was one department called textile. And so I was in this department. No one in this department was doing textile anymore. So we were actually more busy with something connected to soft materials. So we called the department soft sculpture. So someone was more into music and some kind of like computer programming. Someone else was into VJing. Someone else was doing performances, or someone else into writing or installation. That's what I did. My approach to sculpture was always invested into the making, like the archive of its own making. So I was interested in what happens with the body of the spectator, what happens with the maker making the sculpture, or the placing of things. And that's why I became interested in, let's say, minimal art. And the proposal is quite interesting because it's not anymore about just the sculpture itself, but it's a sculpture in relation to the space, in relation to the body of the beholder. There was this guy who wrote this big article, this Michael Frith, Art and Objecthood, which is really funny. It's a very good text. And then I got interested in like, okay, so he's talking about a form of objecthood, material objecthood. And what is that kind of relationship with the thing, the container of the thing, and the thing beholding the thing? And then I got interested more into immaterial objecthood. So the question of that same set of relations, but like relating to immateriality. So how to rematerialize all this stuff that are actually not very tangible. And then I got somehow interested more and more in performance, because it was always this idea of the archive of its own making, so being busy with the making or the doing or the activity. So I went into performance. That brought me to choreography. I went to that school. That was quite interesting because it was not choreography in terms of like, to still the making of forms, of living forms, but it was like a very open-minded idea of what choreography is, because it's the organizing of the living. So from their own management is a form of choreography, or like a book is also a form of choreography, because it's dealing with the living. So to me, that was not so far from each other. With Adriano, we have this story that runs through and that is quite interesting. It's a nail polish story. Brilliant artist Kruturak, a nail polish that she bought, it was like kind of silver, not fully mirror, but quite shiny. And so she started to use it. And then later on, Adriano found it, a cheaper version, and he started to use it. Through using it, later on, this polished nail started to pop up in the piece of Maria Sabbe, Premiere. And then there was the polished nail. And then it popped up in another piece by Mette Ingvardsen, The Nature. And then it popped up again in another piece. And all of a sudden, this polished nail was moving everywhere. It brought the question of, is that about people taking each other's ideas or being inspired by each other? Or is it about the polished nail using people in order to establish itself into a field or into history? Or like, what if we reverse that thing? And then also this question of that Valentina Desideri once, she was talking about the idea of an insistence, something that insists. If you look around, and then there are forms that are insisting through people, instead of like giving so much attention or intention to the people, what if you try to focus on the insistence of the shape in time and space? The entire art history that could be rewrote just by the idea of the insistence of shapes rather than the people who have been hosting those shapes or like mediating those shapes. Like the thought questionnaire I've sent you, for me, was also trying to understand the materiality of thoughts, because to me, thoughts are very material. we have this dichotomy of like body and mind, and then conceptual works or like embodied works. And then to me, this is bullshit, because a work using the body can be extremely like insensitive and unsensual, while thought can have like a lot of flesh. This third question, it was really about investigating that materiality and how do we deal with the ownership and the usership of thoughts. If we own a thought, or if we feel responsible for them, or if that thought is yours, or if you got it, if ideas or thoughts are moving, and how do they move? I would be interested in finding someone who really drew a history of ideas. Okay, my hypothesis would be that we were all the time like priests. They were copying someone else's thoughts constantly. An idea of a thought didn't have like any property per se. It could move as you want it, but then maybe forms, there was a ownership of forms. Who was painting that? But then the idea behind were like traveling freely. But then with conceptual art, and it's also the era of information, the idea was becoming the work of art. So we had to find a way of giving value to this idea. So an idea started to need to have an exchange value, up to the point that it's about, you stole my idea, because my idea is encapsulated and then it can travel from one place to another. So like, how did we move from ideas or thoughts that move freely, although forms are like very specific and hosted or owned, and then we kind of like swap that, where like forms are like traveling freely, but ideas are starting to be crystallized through property. Choreographing the living involves like many, many things that we noticed or not noticed, that are recognized or not recognized. I was like reading about a story. It's a border control, and the person doing the, when you are checking whether people are passing on, like the checkpoint. There was a guy that was passing with a donkey, and the border controller was sure that this guy is a smuggler. So it's like checking, so the donkey is there, full of straws. So the controller is like taking away all the straws, saying, I'm sure you are smuggling something, and then looking at everything and then not finding anything, and then letting him go and being, I'm sure you are smuggling something. And the guy is passing again 1 week later, and the same goes on, and then it's like checking. And for 10 years, he could never find what this guy was smuggling. This border controller, maybe 12 years later, get retired. And once he find the smuggler at the marketplace, and so he goes to him and say like, please tell me, because I really need to know. I know you're a smuggler, but what were you smuggling? And then he tells him, well, I was smuggling donkeys. So it's quite interesting, this thing of like, what is it that we are expecting to look for? I mean, sometimes things are invisible because we take them for granted. We don't recognize them. Something is visible as long as we recognize it. But the moment that we cease to recognize it, because we take it for granted, then it becomes invisible. I have a practice of to become invisible. It's a practice I've been doing for about 5 years, to learn how to become invisible through different techniques that I found, also different phenomenon, like one that is called the spontaneous human invisibility phenomenon. And so people that testify that it became invisible for a time span of 7 to 15 minutes. Practicing this, to me, is not about, like, the moment that I start to work on it and practice it until becoming invisible, it is asking me actually a whole other bunch of questions, which is also like, how do we attend to things? How long is our attention span? How do we foreground or background something? What is the hierarchy of things? Maybe visible and invisible, they are not opposite to each other. I think that they wear the same costume. They have the same clothes. Sometimes we don't see it, or we see it. It's like a camouflage jacket in the forest. It's totally invisible. But a camouflage jacket in the city is actually very visible. Do I have a technique? First, I want to say, like, 2 days ago, I was in the metro, sitting on the metro, and then there was a beggar that entered and I started to come and ask for money, and how everyone is actually managing to make that person invisible by working on being busy with something else, looking somewhere else, not responding, while that person is obviously there. This is a choice also, I think. So how do I manage to be invisible? Because it relates to camouflage, but I think it also relates to techniques of the self. Also, I think like how you use your energy field, how do you deal with your posture, how you are in relation to the space, yourself in relation to others. And when I talk about energy field, you could think of chakra, which is this different spots of energies in your body that actually are somehow shining through, and they compose more or less your aura. And sometimes your aura is like more or less strong, or like when someone is like deeply shiny, then the aura is very strong. Maybe if you would imagine to choreograph that energy field, then you can actually really play with that levels of presence. Maybe the moment that you start to be strongly recognizable, maybe that's the moment that you lose agency. I also feel that this moment of like partial invisibility allow you actually to be many things. Maybe it's also, there is a fantasy, but it's also like the person in the shadow, or the person with a hoodie. It's someone that is not recognizable, so that person can be many things. This person that you have been seeing a lot, but you don't remember, actually that person can and could be, or could have been many things for you, or done many things, but because it was not remembered or recognized, then actually there many things could have happened. Maybe I don't explain it well, but in relation to camouflage, or like a spy, yeah, is the best performer because it has the ability of being many, of not being remembered, yet actually having a lot of agency. And the moment that one is recognized, one is completely locked into one thing that we know from you, and we know how you move, or we know how you think, or we know who you are. So you actually cannot do this or that or that or that. Then what happens if you do the cleaning for 3 days and then you don't clean for 1 day, and then the week after there's a cleaning lady coming, and then when it's very hard to understand what is your relation to cleaning, so then I cannot grasp that. From that moment, you can have many relations to cleaning. I don't know, and I cannot know, because you are many things towards cleaning, which allows you like many, many possibilities. That's the principle of queerness, no? Because that's also the problem that's happening at the moment, that queer starts to become a solidified representation, which is the opposite of queerness. The principle of queerness is like this idea of queer diagonal. It's about like cutting through. It's maybe dealing with different levels of readability. And the moment that it's clearly readable that you're queer, then it's the moment that actually you became furthest away from queerness. At the times that we are dealing with overexposure, because it's overexposure, there are more and more stuff that are being concealed. There was this guy, René Magritte, who was saying that the invisible has nothing to hide. It's only in the visible that you can hide something. The invisible is super boring. In the realm of visible, then that's where you can hide something. Because I see the table, I can hide a dog under the table. You know, if the dog is invisible, I don't care. I mean, it's not there also. So the lie is not this one. The lie is like what you're building to conceal that. This lying architecture, which I found so beautiful, because you construct something around so that actually this empty space is the thing that no one should know, like the secret. This guy, amazing, Chevalier d'Eon, it was like 17th and 18th century, was a spy for the French crown. So as a spy, had to also involve to be a transvestite, cross-dresser, to actually work in the Russian and then in the British kingdoms. He/she became like a spy, then double agent, then triple agent, using also forms of cross-dressing in order to like fully use that. And there's this amazing book of Brian O'Doherty, who wrote this, The Ideology of the White Cube, which is actually very interesting in relation to that. He wrote this biography, which is a fictional biography of Chevalier D'Eon throughout all this period, and goes through all this idea of like lie, but also scams and rumors, and also like how connection with information and secrecy. Like Chevalier D'Eon was part of this whole big secret of the Louis XIV, which is basically the beginning of spy agency and the intelligence agency. All this relation with like information and fake information, and how to cross check all those elements and how to play with them, how to choreograph the truth or how to choreograph information, and as well how to choreograph the self in order to move within those different realms. Virginia Woolf, in this Orlando, at some point she writes that a biographer, in order to make her or his correct job, has to manage to document or capture at least 4 lives of the person that she or he is making the biography of. Whereas that person could have like 1,000 lives as well. Is this idea of that if you want to be a good biographer, you need to manage to understand at least 4 lives of that person. But that person might have even more lives. There are different stories why I started to work with rumors, but there was this book that I found quite interesting. I forgot the title of the book. He wrote about the hierarchy, like social hierarchy of information. So you have like the upper class of information in terms of like the forms that information takes, or lower class of those forms. A fact or scientific fact is pretty much upper class, but rumor is pretty much lower class. But now we start to get having troubles because you start having different forms that start to be able to change, shapeshift. So there's a shapeshifting of forms of information, which gets very harder to understand what is that. So it's like smugglers between different levels. And I was interested in how rumor, by being very lower class, I think also I don't like it so much, this idea of class, but that's for the story. What I'm interested in, like how an information can take different forms in order to move. It's a little bit like a Polish nail story. The only need is like how the story will ensure its own survival. So how it will move by itself. Rather than saying that I'm spreading a story, it's more that a story is living through me and using me in order to be passed on. And if the story is good enough, then collectively we ensure its survival. But it's also very connected to a concrete situation because it emerged from a space of ambiguity. Contrary to the gossip is connected to a fact. It's very easy to say that person slept with that person 2 nights ago. We both know both of those person, or at least one of the person, and that's a gossip that can be a chain reaction. But with the rumor would be more the same way that tabloids, they work. Leonardo DiCaprio went and isolated himself on a beach for the past 2 weeks. What happened? And from this what happened, then we are all gonna try to figure out what happened. And that's how the rumor starts. And that's how tabloids, they are working. Because then they can write a full article trying to speculate on what could happen. And next week, they can still speculate on that. So it's a space of ambiguity that collectively we try to resolve. That is also a social choreography of sorts. So how do we get information? How is it being passed on? How does it take different shapes, although the story or the information itself still move? And then I get quite interested in how we mediate, or how things are like, again, not being controlled, but they manage to actually still be passed on and on and on without having a clear frame of being calibrated into how they can move. It deals with conversational tools. So we are in a conversation, I'm gonna tell you an anecdote, so you still get my attention. Oh no, I get your attention. We're gonna talk about the weather because we feel a bit uncomfortable, we don't know what to say. all of those stuff, it's kind of a noise, but it's how we manage to take care of each other or deal with each other. There are these people that they wrote about, like, what are the conditions for conversations? And one was about reducing anxiety. We are in an elevator. Immediately we're going to start to talk because we are both in this small space. We don't know each other. So we're going to talk in order to reduce the anxiety of you and I being in the space. But then there's also the other, which is about, like, how do we shape our social choreography? Like, I'm going to say nice jokes and funny jokes so I get the attention, so I can sculpt myself within the surrounding and blah, blah, blah. And then there's the other one, which is about mediating or passing on informations. Have you heard that? Or I'm reading a book at the moment and this is... But the three of them are also kind of completely mixed up. We started Galerie for many, many reasons. The Polish Nail story is part of them. Another reason was that we wanted to get a house in Tuscany. Another would be that then the artists that we represent, we found that those works were super exciting, and then they were like bringing problems. And for us, aesthetical, political level or emotional, or they were making us think, or they were like interesting problems. But we thought that we're also bringing good problems for economy, of like how those works are circulating. And so all along for us, the idea of economy was mostly about how things circulate and how they shape where and how they circulate, or the people through which they circulate. So indeed, immaterial economy is, it feels right, but it's not the correct term. As my grandmother always says, the internet is very material. It's just that it's hiding somewhere else. It's more how do we relocate the moment that we take away the object. That means that actually all the rest start to appear, and all the conditions, other things start to become more present or more relevant or more valuable. So if there's not the object, then actually that's maybe alibi or an opportunity to think that, ah, actually maybe that's the experience that is actually the most valuable. Or the moment that we take away the commodity aspects, then we understand that, ah, actually maybe the commodity aspect is becomes time, because time is also a commodity. So it's not about materiality, because time is also material. But the moment that you take away this possibility to have like an element that becomes mediation between a body, an experience, and then this experience in time, then it becomes just the experience in time. So it becomes also, time's also becoming either criteria of value or something, or a way of experiencing. I think that for us, it's more about practicing the problem and really trying to figure out where does that lead. There was this friend of mine, she was hired by an alcohol brand company. And so every summer, no, not every summer, only one summer actually. And so she went to south of France and she was hired with like five other performers or actors. And they were supposed to go every evening to a bar or a restaurant and like enact a birthday party, something like, oh, they haven't seen each other for a long time, and create a situation where they would also invite other people in the bar and they would pay them drinks. That would be drinks of that specific cocktail. In order to produce an experience, on one hand, then the bartender will be like, what is that cocktail? I don't know about it. And so I make you one. And then also the person trying the cocktail being like, oh, that's a nice cocktail, and can tell the story the day after. Like, I had such a good evening with those people, invited me for a drink, this cocktail, so I order it and make you try. And how does that disseminate? And so slowly and slowly, we end up more and more in those levels of service, or levels of the affective and the commercial are starting to have like very interesting intercourses. What happens there? So probably gallery is also completely surfing also on those questions. With the idea of immaterial economy, there's something quite also interesting when collectors, or like people that are really involved as agents or like patrons of the art, most of them are involved in finances. So they're all involved in like the complete dematerialization. So speculation, finances that are not anymore connected with transaction of goods, but transactions of service or transaction of stock options. We end up in another form of materiality, which is maybe intangible, but it takes shape through other matters. How does that shape the world, but also how their profession or their way of being could also make possible also practices that are similarly dealing with those kinds of things. I mean, we also at a period of time that it's not for nothing that we end up having like artworks that are like more and more dealing with bodies and experience and notion of time, and then we end up more and more into works like you are hired by a company and they tell you, okay, you've 3 months to make yourself useful for the company. We don't give you any function, just make yourself useful for the company. Or like, how do we deal with our own schedule or our own time? Where is the currency there? It's about the performance of information, exactly the fetish of the forms of information, forms that are dealing with bureaucracy. That was somehow the only way of rendering tangible those ideas. I mean, how low and conceptual art are like so implicated with each other, because they needed so much each other to make that possible. Because for the first time you had to create like an idea or information as property. And that's really fucked up. The premise is actually about the fact that art has left the building. And then it's like, fuck, what are we going to do with that? Which is like super exciting. They make it leave the building, but then they use not the white cube. I mean, although they reinforce the white cube, but then they need low in order to make art possible, because then the plinth has disappeared. So then they need something else to like be the venue and the materialization of the work. In relation to that thing of the document, that's why we kind of stated that by material we mean that it cannot be reduced to an object or to the documentation of an action, meaning like we throw all of this away in order to really try to rethink where does the work starts and ends. If you get the possibility of the object or the like the prop or the trace or the document, then actually you say there's a location for the art. But the moment that we start to refuse that, or at least to represent works that are not busy with that, you start to re-ask where is the site of the work. For the artists that we represent, like most of them, they are not interested in saying the site is my body. They are not interested at all in that. But then it just brings the question of where is the site of the work? Where does the work localize itself? Bringing back to the first thing of immaterial objecthood, when you start to actually think of that relationality between different things. With Galerie, we think a lot, we are talking about it. We are quite interested in relational aesthetics, but without the aesthetics of relations. There's this guy who wrote this super funny text. I mean, it's not funny actually. Reza Negaristani. I've sent it to you, no? Hypercamouflage, the militarization of peace. It's drawing upon like contemporary strategies of warfare, most specifically about terrorism and techniques of terrorism, that are drawing upon this simple biological thing, which is like a specific fungus that grows on the leaf of a tree. It's called the dieback situation. So the fungus dries on the leaf of the tree, gets on the leaf until the tree basically has hard time to make a difference between the leaf that has been contaminated and the leaf that is healthy. And so the tree starts to kind of destroy itself because its human system is not really able to make the difference. So basically it's dying by killing itself from the inside because not being able to know. This question of paranoia is completely used in techniques of terrorism, being like an hyper camouflage to the point of like not knowing who, as part of the citizen of a government or of a state, are potential terrorists or are actually normal citizens. So then the state is starting to create like hyper security and start to control its citizens and to start to disconnect them and try to dig into them to the point of actually starting to destroy its own humanity by actually starting to fall apart from the inside. Because not being able to make the difference between who is a potential terrorist and who is a citizen. Because at that moment, anyone is a potential terrorist. And at the same time, no one is, because it's hard to know who. I feel that there's something interesting about getting into a system, being so well camouflaged to the point of being indistinguishable from another of those entities, and through that actually forcing the whole system to restructure it itself. There are no Spanish collectors that are collecting those kinds of work, but for sure Arco or many galleries would have to actually think twice by like starting to see those kinds of practices on the market or kinds of galleries starting to operate like that. Structurally, it is pushing them to rethink their own position. Jessica started in 2014. Yeah, it's pretty young, but at the same time, it had many lives before. The title of the work, Jessica, came from another work I did before, which was like a set of audio guides, bringing you to like a visit in a space or in a museum, and basically you would have like other stories that will deviate you from a normal visit. There was the story of this person that is in the space. That person is Jessica, and that's the person that you see all the time, but you don't know who is she. The title Jessica came from that person in the audio guide. Jessica has been working through many, many different functions. So as a guest list manager, as a guest at a dinner, lately was a substitute of a curator, also a voicemail, a background dancer, many, many different jobs, let's say. The principal is background actor in movies, but in real life. It's running since a while. Sometimes Jessica has no appearances for a while, and then all of a sudden there are many appearances. And then it really circulates through word of mouth. Like, people hear about Jessica. They don't really know what it is fully. I just had an email today about someone saying, like, so far I didn't really know who or what Jessica is. One feels that Jessica can do something. So far, I've been the only available body for the works of Jessica. But it could also happen that you have a concert to make really sure that it's a sold-out audience. Then you hire like 15 Jessicas. And then in that case, basically, you would have concert and there will be 50 people under the name of Jessica being there as a normal audience. Then the employer will have to be very specific. What are the things that Jessica can do, or what are the things that Jessica cannot do? Because it's also very hard when it's not really precise to really morph into the subjectivity of the job. If you are a light technician in a theater and then you have to work, probably you are very enthusiastic the first hour, but then because you have like also many technical stuff to do, then at some point you get a little bit like less enthusiastic and a little bit more down to earth, because it's also about technique. So how work also is like completely shaping who you are and what you are doing. A toilet lady also has to perform differently the job, to be a different person. I would be interested one day to be checked by the tax office. Selling a work that is called Jessica, that could be also seen as a disguised work, or selling works like as an artist. It's a commercial gallery. Jessica could definitely be the possibility to do like hidden labor, or not black money, but jobs that is illegal somehow as an artist, but still by saying it's a work of art, you know? Because Jessica has been clearly doing jobs and being paid as a work of art. I'm selling the work of art. So I'm getting artist rights for the presentation of Jessica. The artist rights, they change because I'm the body of Jessica. So because I'm doing the work, then I'm paid as the person doing the work and presenting the work, because I'm the artist also. But if someone from the tax office will check that and will be, so you have been a toilet lady and you have been paid 700 euros for an evening and you say it's a work of art, what the fuck? And then you have another invoice and you're asking author rights for the performance of gallery, which is actually the selling of an artwork by another artist. What the fuck? There was this big problem at some point. He was Romanian and he was making sculpture, and he was based in Paris, and he was making those sculptures that were like super round and really Brancusi. This trial of Brancusi. You know, when the work of art like arrived in New York and they were saying like, this is not a work of art. You should pay the taxes of, like, this is just stone, or like, this is just metal. And then they were saying, no, it's a work of art, you know, so you should have a different taxation and stuff. And it went on trial against the United States to kind of like prove what is art or what is not art, in order to actually get through the tax. The tax were like on trial with the artist. I mean, it's a very funny thing.